Well, I did get to go see that movie. Did I mention that before?
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. Never mind. Actually, it's funny because I learned the same thing there as I did on that retreat that I went to, that after I passed the point of no return, then I experienced some peace. And maybe that's something we'll speak about now because we're going to talk about acceptance. To ease into the acceptance piece, it's funny because that was a really good meeting that we just had. I want to thank Dan for speaking, who's not here and nobody else is either. But yeah, Dan, thanks, man. That was excellent. And I don't know how you tolerated this light. You were real close to it. That was good. I was sitting in the back and I was thinking, you know, acceptance, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's sort of my experience that there's sort of two extremes of acceptance. Either I have it or I don't. It's kind of not like levels of it. It's either I'm just not there or I am there. It's kind of, you know, it's the distance between the two are usually far between. And a real obvious lead into the concept or topic of acceptance is the Serenity Prayer. There's an article in your packet on the Serenity Prayer called The Serenity Prayer Way of Life. You'll have to turn there because most of it you'll hear in a few minutes. But it's interesting how the Serenity Prayer, it's really kind of unusual because growing up, the Serenity Prayer was in my kitchen. And then I came to AA and I saw it again and I was just like, wow, that's really weird. And what was also really weird was that my parents, we moved into this house, the house that my parents still live in. And in the basement of that house, there was a sign that my parents kept and still have in my house today of a temperance poster that talked about the progress of the drunkard. And it started with, you know, social, and then, you know, he starts having problems, and then he's out in the street, and then he kills himself. And I'm like, how? It's like my parents knew or something, you know what I mean? Like, they were watching the progression in real life. It was like it came alive, like in the room next to where they slept, you know? But the Serenity Prayer is a really beautiful prayer. However, when the Serenity Prayer is kind of studied, or maybe better yet, when the Serenity Prayer is internalized as a way of life, it's an incredible tool in dealing with moment by moment, going through, dealing with life happenings. And it's kind of interesting. I've thrown this out. I actually had one person argue with me, but maybe somebody else will too, but the first line of the Serenity Prayer, I think, is wrong, for lack of a better expression, because, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Now, for me, the serenity came after the acceptance, not before. Serenity didn't create the acceptance. In my experience, the acceptance created the serenity. But I'm not here to argue with a really beautiful prayer. However, as the prayer goes along, for me, like I said, there's an incredible way of life there. And as the prayer goes along, it says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And what's found in that prayer are the only two healthy options that we have in regard to anything that's disturbed us. I can either make changes or I can change my perspective. That's it. Complaining about it isn't a healthy option. That's old behavior. Getting people to co-sign it is not a healthy response because that's old behavior. There's only two things that I can do. Either make a change or change my perspective. That's it. It's actually pretty simple. But, of course, when we're in the trenches, it's a whole nother thing. But what I've also seen in dealing with the Serenity Prayer and trying to make it into a way of life is that 95% of the time, the things I cannot change are outside of me. And 95% of the time, the things I can change are inside of me. So it's kind of interesting in looking at that prayer, because not only is it a really beautiful prayer, but it's a really interesting way of life. It really gets down to a healthy response to things that are disturbing me. And then, of course, it gets into the last part, which is, I guess, something that always eluded me. You know, my life, if you had looked at my life, you wouldn't characterize it or describe it as having wisdom. You know what I mean? Like, there was this random freak kind of way of life that I was living. You know, the wisdom definitely wasn't part of the way that I was living for 30 years. You know what I mean? But there's two kind of interesting descriptions that I've seen of wisdom that I think capture the essence of what I think wisdom is. First of all, wisdom is the perfect combination of knowledge and love. That, you know, earlier we talked about the four absolutes and we talked about honesty, you know. I'm sorry to say this, but honesty without love is abuse. That's an extreme statement, but that's what I believe. And don't get me wrong, sometimes love doesn't come into play when you're dealing with honesty. Honesty is just honesty, it just is. But, you know, me going around telling people, you know, being honest in a ruthless kind of a way without compassion, I think dips into abuse, almost abuse, you know what I mean? And the other expression that I think kind of captures the essence of wisdom is thinking with the end in mind. And I'm sorry to say this and use this as an example, but it's just a perfect example that smoking cigarettes is not characteristic of wisdom because it's not thinking with the end in mind. Now, I'm not taking anybody's inventory. That's just the example I usually use. I'm not trying to suggest that you shouldn't smoke. I really don't care. Again, you know, it's just interesting in looking at that prayer and seeing that, you know, first of all, most of the things that I cannot change are outside of me. You know what I mean? Like, and most of the things that I can change are just right here. Again, it's an inside job. It's all, you know, in a positive way, it's all about me. You know, the mirroring thing and the inside, I mean, it's just inevitably, it has nothing to do with what's going on out there. Inevitably, it has what I'm seeing out there is really what I'm experiencing in here. I mean, that's been my experience. I find trying to grow spiritually and trying to be more loving and trying to live this whole way of life, all of it. And it's interesting because that's another thing I always like saying is that there's only one thing harder than living this whole program and this whole way of life, and that's not living this whole program and this whole way of life. That I've lived that way too, and it's kind of an interesting middle of the road, half measured. You know, waiting for when's the other foot going to fall? When's the other shoe going to fall? When's the next tragedy? Because today I don't have that sense really anymore. Today it's more of a sense of I have ways to deal with anything. I've experienced things that were difficult. I've experienced things that were painful. I've experienced things that were tragic. I experienced in about a 2 or 3 month period of time my marriage ending, a woman that I was in love with and didn't even really know that it was ending or moving in that direction. About a month later, a really close friend of mine died from this disease. And about a month later, I started a new job that I had no background in, and that was very difficult, and I basically had to train myself. And all that was going on at the same time. I had three major life issues going on all at the same time. And still deep down, I had this incredible sense of I know that everything's going to be okay and that I'm nothing more than just sitting in God's hand going through life. And I don't know about anybody else here, but I never had that sense of I know that I'm going to be okay, even when things were okay. You know what I mean? I always had that sense of how am I going to self-sabotage whatever good I'm going to get myself into? I always had that sense of, you know, I'm just going to ruin it. I don't, you know what I mean? I always had that sense of just waiting for the next, you know, having no tools to deal with it and having no sense of everything is okay. I never had that sense even when things were calm. So I don't know. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Serenity Prayer. In regard to that wisdom piece, I forgot about that. I was talking about that, you know, thinking with the end in mind and the perfect combination of knowledge and love. That it's interesting in our steps that really it gives some glimpses of it and points toward it, but it really doesn't talk about tapping into that wisdom until kind of like the ninth step where it talks about that God is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. And all over step 11, it talks about being inspired and being guided. And, you know, we now have conscious contact with that that is within us, that was always there, that we just had blocked off. And, you know, that's when I can have a deeper sense of the acceptance of my shortcomings. Mike had talked about that in a really great way, that I need to accept my humanness. I need to see that even the ways that I fall short, God uses as a way for my growth and to help others. That if I didn't make mistakes, the people that I would want to work with wouldn't be able to relate to me. You know what I mean? Nobody would, you know what I mean? Like, that the wisdom from the inside really starts coming into play toward the later parts of the steps. And you know, then the fruition of that whole prayer just kind of just explodes. That, you know, something that perhaps is, you know, my peace has been disturbed, sort of like the 10-step stuff, you know, my peace has been disturbed. I can make changes, or I can change my perspective. And hopefully tap into the wisdom of which one is it. You know what I mean? Which one is it? Sometimes the most right thing is to do nothing. And sometimes the most wrong thing is to do something. You know, so again, you know, just for me, it's an incredible prayer, but it's also just an even more infinitely wonderful way of life. And this is also in your packet, but I wanted to just read it because a lot of people don't know that the Serenity Prayer is actually, the Serenity Prayer that we know is actually shortened, and this is actually the Serenity Prayer in its entirety. No, I just realized that. I don't think it's in here. Oh, I'm sorry. Here it is. Okay. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen. And I have there attributed to Reinhold Niebuhr. I understand that it probably was it probably came before him, but generally it's attributed to him, although I believe, in all honesty, that it wasn't from him. Now, what's interesting about that last part is I remember sort of having an argument. I don't know why. I always tell stories about how I'm laying in bed and I have these incidences. But I sort of had an argument with someone. I was laying in bed and I read that last part of the prayer, and they were really offended by the part that says that, you know, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace. And I don't think the focus of that sentence is so much on the hardship. I think the focus on that sentence is more the acceptance, that I need to accept that God's in charge. And to be honest with you, whether I accept that or not, it doesn't change the fact that God's in charge. Whether I like it or not, it doesn't change anything. I can either accept the reality of the situation that God is in charge, or I can fight it and have problems with it. You know what I mean? That for me, that's what that part is saying, that it's not just, you know, I should just look forward to misery the rest of my life because that's going to do something for me, but that I need to accept when difficult things come and look for perhaps the good in it and get a different perspective toward it and maybe see what's my part in this. So, you know, maybe I'm contributing to it or even creating it, but that, you know, hardship isn't necessarily a bad thing when it's used to bring about a good thing, and when it's used to bring about my growth and to help others grow also. So, I don't know. That's it on the Serenity Prayer.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. A topic we didn't talk about this weekend, but yet I think we've been pointing towards it all weekend, is surrender. And when I look upon my alcoholism and when I look upon any difficulties that I have today, it's always surrender which comes before acceptance. This struck me a couple years ago, and it didn't make sense to me right away until I began to actually experience it. But I don't know about any of you guys, but for years I would sit in meetings and hear, you know, someone would walk into a meeting with a problem, or someone would have difficulties stopping drinking, and inevitably you would just get the old-timer in the back of the room with his arms folded, and he would say, "Kid, all you got to do is just surrender." And you get a guy like me, and I'm just kind of sitting there shaking my head wondering, well, how do you do that? How do you just surrender? Is this something you do? Are there steps involved? Is it a puzzle that you put together? Are there directions somewhere? You know, or is this some secret lock that you have on between you and God? You know, and what I began to realize, not through my act of alcoholism necessarily, but after I had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, and then I began to see other problems come up in my life, whether it be other addictions or just other defects of character, and I began to see that surrender happens to me and for me. And it's not something that I can muster up the willpower to do. Surrender is something that happens to me and for me, and it's usually as the result of the grace of God. Or a lot of pain on my part. And nowadays I really don't see the difference between the two of those. I think they're one and the same. I think quite often my pain is the grace of God, is a gift from God. And I also see willingness as the same thing. It just takes on different forms. But when I look upon my alcoholism, and I think that when one of our friends reads a couple paragraphs from Dr. Paul's story, I think he even talks about this. When I finally surrendered to my act of alcoholism, I accepted it, and it wasn't before. You know, I had no peace, I had no serenity, I had no acceptance until surrender happened to me and for me, and I ended up in a jail, didn't know how I got there, didn't remember what I did to get there, woke up with a green sheet on my chest, didn't believe a word that it said, didn't believe the detective said that I had done. Didn't believe the other person that was supposedly involved said I'd done. But yet somehow I knew I was finished. I was beat. I was done. I hit bottom. I didn't know what that was. I asked a guy one time, well, how do you hit bottom? And he says, kid, put down the shovel and quit digging. I like that.
Hulk Hogan?
No, I would have said brother. Only one person in the room got that, and I'm married to her. Guys, I ran out of stuff to say right about noontime. It's been a real interesting experience for me. But as I go through the steps, I can see the... I don't want to use the word progression, but I can see how surrender always precedes acceptance. You know, I have to surrender to my powerlessness before I can accept it. I have to surrender that there is a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity before I can accept that. I have to surrender that I really need to make this decision to go ahead with the rest of the steps before I can accept that. When I saw my truth in the fourth step, I was brought to a place of surrender. God bless you. And I accepted that was my truth, that my troubles are of my own making. And I shared this inventory with another person because I was at a total place of surrender. I had, for me to think that I have a choice whether I drink again is insane. And for me to think that I have a choice in many other areas of my life is insane. For me to think I had a choice whether I was going to come here this weekend is insane. If I'm supposed to come here, I'm here. If I'm not supposed to come here, I'm not here. And I can go on with the rest of the steps like that. And, you know, with my character defects, when I hate to keep using Kathy as an example, but she's the best one I got. When I get angry at her, it's not about her, it's about me. And when I've surrendered to that truth, because I know that is a truth in my life, acceptance comes. She can do anything she wants. And I love her when I'm in that state, when I'm in fit spiritual condition, when I'm in touch with that truth. There's I came across, by the way, I didn't give my language and a heart plug this weekend. There's a really excellent book published by the AA Grapevine called The Language at Heart. It's a collection of all of Bill Wilson's Grapevine writings. It's tremendous. All his writings on the traditions are in there. Probably my most favorite Bill W. article on emotional sobriety, The Next Frontier, that's in there. Could do an entire weekend on that. And this article, What is Acceptance? So at this time, I'd like to, let's invite all three of them up here. Meg is going to read a few paragraphs from Dr. Paul's story, Dr. Alcoholic Addict, his thing on acceptance. And then Chris from Maryland and our friend Martha from Pennsylvania are going to go through What is Acceptance article.
Hi, everyone. My name is Meg, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Meg.
Most definitely, I am an alcoholic. Okay, I'm going to read Part of Acceptance Was the Answer, page 416 in the fourth edition, 449 in third edition. At last, acceptance proved to be the key to my drinking problem. After I had been around AA for 7 months, tapering off alcohol and pills, not finding the program working very well, I was finally able to say, okay, God, it is true that I, of all people, strange as it may seem, and even though I didn't give my permission, really, really am an alcoholic of sorts. And it's all right with me. Now, what am I going to do about it? When I stopped living in the problem and began living in the answer, the problem went away. From that moment on, I have not had a single compulsion to drink. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. Shakespeare said, "All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players." He forgot to mention that I was the chief critic. I was always able to see the flaws in every person, every situation. And I was always glad to point it out because I knew you wanted perfection just as I did. AA and acceptance have taught me that there is a bit of good in the worst of us and a bit of bad in the best of us. That we are all children of God and we each have a right to be here. When I complain about me or about you, I am complaining about God's handiwork. I am saying that I know better than God. Acceptance is the key to my relationship with God today. I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for Him to tell me what to do. Rather, I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to Him. However it turns out, that's God's will for me. I must keep my magic magnifying mind on my acceptance and off my expectations, for my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. When I remember this, I can see I've never had it so good. Thank God for AA. Of course, when Bill asked me to share on this, I was like, oh, gosh, what am I going to say? I came into the program of AA, and I readily surrendered and accepted I was an alcoholic and that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was the answer for me. And I worked very hard to get to where I'm at, which is nine-step amends. And for the first time last week, it's pretty funny that I read this, I had the first bout of bad news that I've had in a long time. I was diagnosed with what's called complex partial epilepsy. And my first reaction was, oh, this is great. I go and get sober, and now I'm going to have to be on medication. And right away, the why me starts. You know, why now? Why now? And I was full of fear. I was convinced I had a big brain tumor growing in my head. And when I went for my MRI, they said, why are you here? And I said, I have a big fat brain tumor. And it turned out I don't. Thank God for that. But for the first time in a long, long time, I had to accept something that was unacceptable to me. And I struggled with that for days. And it's funny, we came here and last night I was laying in bed and I wasn't feeling so good last night. And I surrendered it last night. And I haven't had any problems today. I feel terrific. And there's some power behind that. I don't know what it is. I don't think I'm cured. I know that there's a reason for this, and I need to go through it, whatever it is, and I accept that. For many months, I've been the thy will be done, girl. That was my answer to everything, and it's a good way to live for me. You know, thy will be done, thy will be done. You know, I don't have enough money, thy will be done. And it's been working, though. It really does work until something, you know, harder comes along, and acceptance is the answer to every problem. Once I get God involved, it's our problem now. You know, I give the problem to Him, and it's still my problem. I still need to go through it to the end. But I do know that everything is going to be okay. I know there's a reason for it, the bigger picture. Early in my sobriety, someone had shared about the tapestry and how I can only see the back, and it's a tangle and a mess of strings, and it really doesn't look very good, but on the other side, it's very beautiful, and that's the side that's facing God, and I think about that a lot. And I'm so grateful to Mike, too, for just stressing the humanness, because I have a lot of trouble accepting the fact that I'm a human being still. I want to be perfect in thought and action and word and deed, and the more I get sober, you know, the more I come alive, and I'm very human, and sometimes it's really hard to sit with that humanness, and that's probably where I'm at right now, you know, just trying to accept the fact that anger is human and lust is human, and keeping that all in the light of God. I think that's it. Thank you for letting me share.
Hi, everyone. My name is Martha, and I'm an alcoholic. What is Acceptance by Bill W., AA Grapevine, March 1962? One way to get at the meaning of the principle of acceptance is to meditate upon it in the context of AA's much unused prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Essentially, this is to ask for the resources of grace by which we make spiritual progress under all conditions. Greatly emphasized in this wonderful prayer is a need for the kind of wisdom that discriminates between the possible and the impossible. We shall also see that life's formidable array of pains and problems will require many different degrees of acceptance as we try to apply this valued principle. Sometimes we have to find the right kind of acceptance for each day. Sometimes we need to develop acceptance for what we may come to pass tomorrow, and yet again we shall have to accept a condition that may never change. Then, too, there frequently has to be a right and realistic acceptance of grievous flaws within ourselves and serious faults within those about us, defects that may not fully be remedied for years, if ever. All of us will encounter failures, some retrievable and some not. We shall often meet with defeat, sometimes by accident, sometimes self-inflicted, and at still other times dealt to us by the injustice and violence of other people. Most of us will meet up with some degree of worldly success, and here the problem of the right kind of acceptance will be really difficult. Then there will be illness and death. How indeed shall we be able to accept all these? It is always worthwhile to consider how grossly that good word acceptance can be misused. It can be warped to justify nearly every brand of weakness, nonsense, and folly. For instance, we can accept failure as a chronic condition, forever, without profit or remedy. We can accept worldly success pridefully, and sometimes wholly of our own making. We can also accept illness and death as certain evidence of a hostile and godless universe. With these twistings of acceptance, we AAs have had vast experience. Hence, we constantly try to remind ourselves that these perversions of acceptance are just gimmicks for excuse-making, a losing game at which we are, or at least have been, the world champions. This is why we treasure our serenity prayer so much. It brings a new light to us that we can dissipate our old time and nearly fatal habit of fooling ourselves. In the radiance of this prayer, we see that defeat, rightly accepted, need be no disaster. We know that we do not have to run away, nor ought again try to overcome adversity by still another bulldozing power drive that can only push up obstacles before us faster than they can be taken down. On entering AA, we became the beneficiaries of a very different experience. Our new ways of staying sober is literally founded upon the proposition that of ourselves we are nothing, the Father doeth the works. In steps 1 and 2 of our recovery program, these ideas are specifically spelled out. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We couldn't lick alcohol with our own remaining resources, and so we accepted that the further fact that dependence upon a higher power, if only our AA group, could do this hitherto impossible job. The moment we were able to fully accept these facts, our release from the alcohol compulsion had begun. For most of us, this pair of acceptances had required a lot of exertion to achieve. Our whole treasured philosophy of self-sufficiency had to be cast aside. This had not been done with old-fashioned willpower. It was instead a matter of developing the willingness to accept these new facts of living. We neither ran nor fought, but accept we did, and then we were free. There had been no irretrievable disaster.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Chris.
Continuing on from the grapevine reading. This kind of acceptance and faith is capable of producing 100% sobriety. In fact, it usually does, and it must, else we could have no life at all. But the moment we carry these attitudes into our emotional problems, we find that only relative results are possible. Nobody can, for example, become completely free from fear, anger, and pride. Hence, in this life, we shall attain nothing like perfect humility and love. So we shall have to settle, respecting most of our problems, for a very gradual progress, punctuated sometimes by heavy setbacks. Our whole attitudes of all or nothing will have to be abandoned. Therefore, our very first problem is to accept our present circumstances as they are, ourselves as we are, and the people about us as they are. This is to adopt a realistic humility without which no genuine advance can ever begin. Again and again, we shall need to return to that unflattering point of departure. This is an exercise in acceptance that we can profitably practice every day of our lives, provided we strenuously avoid turning these realistic surveys of the facts of life into unrealistic alibis for apathy and defeatism. They can be the sure foundation upon which increased emotional health and therefore spiritual progress can be built. At least this seems to be my own experience. Another exercise that I practice is to try for a full inventory of my blessings, and then for a right acceptance of the many gifts that are mine, both temporal and spiritual. Here I try to achieve a state of joyful gratitude. When such a brand of gratitude is repeatedly affirmed and pondered, it can finally displace the natural tendency to congratulate myself on whatever progress I may have been enabled to make in some areas of living. I try hard to hold fast to the truth that a full and thankful heart cannot entertain great conceits. When brimming with gratitude, one's heartbeat must surely result in outgoing love, the finest emotion that we can ever know. In times of very rough going, the grateful acceptance of my blessings, oft repeated, also can bring me some of the serenity of which our prayer speaks. Whenever I fall under acute pressures, I lengthen my daily walks and slowly repeat our serenity prayer in rhythm to my steps and breathing. If I feel that my pain has in part been occasioned by others, I try to repeat, God grant me the serenity to love their best and never fear their worst. This benign healing process of repetition, sometimes necessary to persist with for days, has seldom failed to restore me to at least a workable emotional balance and perspective. Another helpful step is to steadfastly affirm the understanding that pain can bring. Indeed, pain is one of our greatest teachers. Though I still find it difficult to accept today's pain and anxiety with any great degree of serenity, as those more advanced in the spiritual life seem able to do, I can, if I try hard, give thanks for present pain nevertheless. I find the willingness to do this by contemplating the lessons learned from past suffering, lessons which have led to the blessings I now enjoy. I can remember, if I insist, how the agonies of alcoholism, the pain of rebellion and thwarted pride have often led me to God's grace, and so to a new freedom. So as I walk along, I repeat still other phrases such as these. Pain is the touchstone of progress. Fear no evil. This too will pass. This experience can be turned to benefit. These fragments of prayer bring far more than mere comfort. They keep me on the track of right acceptance. They break up my compulsive themes of guilt, depression, rebellion, and pride, and sometimes they endow me with the courage to change the things I can and the wisdom to know the difference. To those who never have given these potent exercise and acceptance a real workout, I recommend them highly the next time the heat is on, or for that matter, at any time.
I want to thank Mike and Bill for asking me to read this tonight, and I didn't know until I came back to the house that I was going to have to share on it as well, which was probably good. I claimed to be an alcoholic long before I accepted the fact that I'm an alcoholic, probably a good 15 years or so. So when I remember sitting in one of my first meetings and just feeling such a sense of relief to honestly say that I'm an alcoholic, and just knowing that that's just what it is. When I first went to my family and I told them that, you know, this is it. I'm gonna get some help. I'm gonna make some changes. My nephew, who was 13 at the time, said to me, "Well, you know, we're predispositioned to be alcoholics." And I'm like, "Well, yeah. That's if I only had accepted that a lot sooner. Good thing you're 13." When we were asked to split this up, I had Mike asked me this morning, so I spent a good part of the morning session counting the number of lines in this and then dividing by two, and Mike would be so proud of me that I was just being like so nuts about it, and then decided what part I was going to read, and then when I came back tonight, completely changed my mind after reading through it again, because the parts that really jumped out at me have been my experience in the past 10 months or so. I left the Wilson House in July and was just on like this great trip. Left there about a week or so later, was up at Fellowship of the Spirit, and you know, I didn't think it could get any better, and it was. During that time, during that weekend, I was beginning to suffer from a physical ailment, which turned into the absolute most painful physical condition I've experienced so far in my life. I was rupturing a disc in my back and didn't know it. So within a week, I was unable to walk. And I just, you know, I was laying there in bed, and I would just lie there and pray. And I would actually, in my mind, imagine, you know, God stepping in as a referee and saying, "All right, step back. Don't feel so sorry for yourself. You've got, you know, good insurance and good medical care, and you're just going to be okay." And I just knew I was going to be okay. So during my recovery time after the surgery, and even like leading up to the surgery, people would say, "Oh, I'll pray for you," and I'm like, "Don't pray for me. Pray for my surgeon. You know, make sure he doesn't have a fight with his wife that morning, or too many drinks at lunch, or you know, whatever. You know, just I'm just there. You know." And I remember going, my sister Jean was with me throughout the entire morning, and there's a lot of hurry up and wait. You have to get to the hospital really early, and they put you through these really awful tests, and if I had an enemy today, I wouldn't even wish a myelogram on them. It's pretty medieval. So throughout the whole day, she stayed with me, and even in this little room before we went in, I went for the surgery, she was with me. And then when I was finally on the gurney and I'm on my way in to go in, start crying. And it wasn't that, it might have been fear, but I just knew how much I was going to miss my sister, and I was really hoping she was going to be okay the rest of the day. That, you know, I was really, you know, was she going to be okay the rest of the day? Because she was going to have to sit around the hospital some more. I was going to be unconscious. I woke up that night and walked from my hospital bed and started walking around the floor, asking the nurses if there were any drunks I could work with. So they sent a social worker in to give me the AA hotline because they thought I needed help. And I said, "No, I want to help." "Well, okay, I'll just go back to bed now." So as I was at home recovering, an old friend of mine stopped by the house, and he said, "You're in a really bad place." He used a different word, though. "You're this age, and you've already had two back surgeries. You know, what are you going to do?" And I was just like, you know, I'm okay. I just know that I'm okay. And he couldn't get that at all. But I just knew. And even during that time when I was recovering, I had friends of mine coming to my house and bringing meetings. I even had when I couldn't leave my bed, I had a conference call meeting with my sponsor and some other people in our support group, which was pretty cool. I had all the right books with me in bed because there's books in bed. And I just knew I'd be okay. And so that part of the reading about when there's illness. So here I had suffered one of the, so far, the worst physical thing. Well, about 6 months after that, I got the news that my whole adult life I dreaded the news that my father's death. And I always thought, oh, it's going to happen in the middle of the night. I'm going to get this awful phone call. And almost a year to the day prior to me getting this news, I had shared my fear inventory with my sponsor, and that was the first thing on there, and we had worked through it. So the day when I got that phone call, I was sitting in my office, and I just finished what I was doing and went and told everyone. I said, I got to go. I got to get to Florida. And I was able to accept my father's death and accept the fact that I love him dearly, and was able to tell him that a few days before he died, and that all the weird things you have to do after someone dies. We had to go and plan a funeral, and we had to go clean out his house, and we had to listen to all. He lived in a retirement community, so we had to accept all his old people friends coming over. And but they all told us the same thing. They all told us what a great man he was, and his life was just committed to service. And he had some, you know, wacky traits about the service that he gave. Like, he was self-taught on the computer, and he hooked up everyone in his community with email and stuff like that. But he would only work on your computer if you were a registered Republican and you had to show your card. He never knew that I'm a registered Democrat. Now he does. So, you know, just these two experiences in the last 10 months of being able to accept an illness and death, that, man, a year and a half ago, I would have never been able to do that. I would have been a total mess. And I'm not a total mess today. And I can even accept that. So with that, that's all I have to share.
Still Chris, still an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
I'd like to say thank you to everyone here, and to the people here at the Wilson House, and to Bill and Bob and Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, acceptance is about faith. You know? And I'll tell you where I came to that, where maybe that understanding was given to me. I drank long enough and hard enough that alcohol, drinking booze, convinced me I couldn't drink. I was able to accept my alcoholism before I got in here, you know. And I came in and got sober for a few months there, you know, wonderful me, I'm doing such a great job staying sober all by myself. And I heard this Serenity Prayer, and probably even had it memorized by that point. So I'm here, I'm a couple months dry, you know. And I went away for the weekend. I went up into New York, and a weekend of real hard physical labor is something I really love doing, so... You know, I came back there, I was physically tired, but emotionally and mentally, I was charged up. I was in a good place. And I'm driving across Route 88, heading west, into the sunset, and all by myself, I was alone. And it was a good sunset. It wasn't a once-in-a-lifetime sunset, it wasn't a once-in-a-year sunset. A lot of wisdom now, back then I had very little. So all this enlightenment was given to me. It's not something I came up with on my own. You know, it was shown to me that moment was truly unique. Never again would I be there for that sunset at that time. And then on the way back, driving down through Pennsylvania, long drive through the night, it was shown to me that every moment everywhere is also truly unique and also truly flush with the grace of God. You know, I just need to get out of the way and see it. And all of a sudden, a lot of the things I'd been hearing in that serenity prayer about acceptance, excuse me, began to make sense. You know, every moment is full of the grace of God, and it's there for me if I choose to see it and choose to accept it. You know, if something's going on and I don't think I like it and I'm unwilling to accept it, well, that's my problem. You know, the good or the bad in things is really in how I perceive them and if I'm willing to accept them or not. And that launched me into some faith. And it was the faith I needed to make a start in recovery in this program, you know. That God truly wasn't going to give me anything that God and I together couldn't handle, you know. I hear people say anything I couldn't handle, and that there's not much I can handle, and especially, you know, I couldn't handle much back then either. So you know, I got sober for a while, and I worked the steps, and I got married, and I got a house, and these material, nice things started coming into my life. Most importantly, I could look in the mirror. You know, I was okay with the person that I had become, all based on this faith and a commitment to do some work following it, you know. And I had a point in my sobriety where I was kind of coasting. And I was slipping back towards a drink. And that faith got a little thin. You know, my ability to accept things at work and at home and in my life, I was getting a little testy. You know, I wasn't seeing that it was really in God's plan and it wasn't in Chris's plan, you know. And then the bomb hit. And I'll talk about this. This is tough for me still. My wife got very sick. My wife got pregnant with our second child, and she got very sick with another fatal progressive disease. And I didn't have the ability to accept that. I didn't have the faith, you know, to get through that and use the tools that I had learned with the 12 steps to do what I had to do to work through that. And I got drunk, you know. And you all know the story. Over any period, always worse, never better. And I can attest to that. And I did some horrible things out there the last time I was out there. My wife is undergoing all sorts of medical treatment. She's pregnant with the baby. She has no idea what's going to happen to the baby as a result of these treatments, and I'm drinking. You know, I couldn't face that, and I'm not proud of that. I don't know what happened. I woke up one morning, and I guess God had enough. You know, God got sick and tired of me being sick and tired of me tearing lives up and me hurting people, you know, and me hurting myself. And I woke up, and I had just enough faith left. I had just enough ability, or was given enough ability, to accept what was going on in my life, you know, to accept that God was in charge and not Chris, to want to be sober that day. And I haven't had a drink since. God is in charge. You know? The wisdom to change, I guess it comes with experience. It comes sometimes through growing through that pain. It comes sometimes from watching other people go through that pain, you know. I work with some guys that have other mental illnesses. They're in a hospital for that stuff. And I see them committed to an institution for taking stuff that I do to an extreme. You know, I there's wisdom there. I don't need to go there. You know, the things I can change, it was talked about. There's not much outside of me that I can change. You know, sometimes God and I together may be able to affect some little change in the world that probably has to do with me getting better and becoming a better person. There's probably not much left of my own devices that I can change inside of me. But with the 12 steps of this program and God's grace and the assistance of people like me that I try to associate with in places like this, this great change has taken place, you know. I have a life worth living today. Yet again, I wake up in the morning and brush my teeth and I look in that mirror and I fit inside my own skin today. Because I accept the limitations that I have, you know. I accept the world that's around me as it is. And I do my best to make it better by making myself better with God's help. So, thank you all again.
So, what is this, like a competition thing? You know what was amazing about that? That was totally random. I had no idea what anybody was going to share about. Kind of like the rest of the weekend, actually. Something that I started becoming a whole lot more hyper aware of in regard to acceptance was how, in looking back through my life, I started seeing that The best, the most obvious example that I can give you was I remember a bunch of years ago, my stepson was 12, and I thought it was time to encourage him to make his bed. Now, for you parents out there, you know what kind of situation that is. And he wasn't cooperating. He wasn't acting the way I wanted him to. And I was having a hard time with it because I thought it was a small thing. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I didn't think it was that difficult. I was trying to instill some responsibility. And I finally reached a point where I said, you know what? This is causing me grief, and it's not worth it. And I finally accepted it for, you know what? If it doesn't change, I could be all right with it. And I backed off, and I never said anything to him again. And the very next day, he started making his bed without anybody saying anything to him, and probably still to this day, he makes his damn bed without anybody saying anything to him. And what's interesting about that statement is that I've seen that many times in my life, but when I'm involved in it, before getting results or before something changing, it's interesting how it's almost like that situation was meant to be a lesson for me. And the moment that I learned the lesson, or the moment that I accepted it, or the moment that I said, you know what, if this doesn't change, I can be all right with it, all of a sudden it just changed without me having to do anything. I've seen it in my marriages. I've seen it in relationships. I've seen it with work. I've seen it in life situations. For me, it's kind of interesting because, you know, logically what makes sense is that I need to get in there and I need to fix it. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I remember reading one time, I think it said something like, you know, God doesn't need my help regulating the world. And that sometimes life is the best parent and life is the best teacher. And that it doesn't have to be me. That I can be all right with however it is, with some form of acceptance or some form of change in perspective. And for some reason, when I reach that point, very often, all of a sudden everything just changes without me really having to do anything. When up until that point, I kept having to try to fix it and change it and change it. And you know what I mean? Like, because I know best, or even if it is a really good idea, nothing's changed, and all of a sudden I accept it, and all of a sudden it just changes. You know what I mean? It's kind of a strange concept, and it's kind of a another one of those things that don't necessarily make sense, but experientially, I'm sure most of you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know? Also, I just want to comment on this, and I don't know, I'm just going on. But I thought it was kind of interesting because it was kind of mentioned with, I think Meg kind of mentioned it with, she didn't use the word, but what she was describing was perfectionism. And as I sat there, I kept laughing to myself because what a cosmic joke that imperfect people try to achieve, you know, that have this deep perfectionism, because that's something that most of us have in common is this perfectionism, you know what I mean? And it's one of the horrors of our lives, basically, I mean, if you think about it. And like, what a cosmic joke that God is playing on us, you know. We have this part of us that wants to be the perfectionist, and it's nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, and it's our constant little grind, you know what I mean? It's our constant little grind is that we want to be perfectionists, and I definitely see that as a cosmic joke.
I'm starting to like this light. It does a real neat thing to this blue glass. I've accepted its brightness.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You didn't get enough sleep last night.
There's a really awesome book out there called Loving What Is. It's by a woman by the name of Byron Katie. I believe it's mentioned in the packet here. She has a really neat tool. It's called the Judge Your Neighbor Worksheet. I love judging my neighbor. Actually, I used to. I don't love it anymore. But what she talks about it in her book is accepting reality, loving what is. I mean, it seems so simple. Like I have a choice to either accept or not accept reality. There is no choice in that. Reality is what is. And I'm going to like flip a coin. I accept it or don't accept it. I'm going to fight it. it just really seems ridiculous to me. Yet sometimes, some days, I still don't want to accept what is. What is what is. And no matter what I think, that's not going to change. The people I work with that relapse, that's not going to change. Our dog, here he is, by the way. We spoke about him last session. Picture up front there.
And he's not panting. He always has his tongue out.
Always. Him having certain behavioral attributes, it's probably our fault anyway. That's not going to change. My wife not behaving the way I want her to behave, that's not going to change. Me having certain characteristics within our home, leaving tapes scattered and different stuff like that, and that's not going to change. Well, I'm working on it. That's been a 6 and 7 deal for me, and maybe next year we'll do an entire weekend on 6 and 7, and I'll let you know my progress in those areas. I know this article was just so powerful for me, and especially towards the end. But really, I want to thank Martha, Meg, and Chris for sharing. That was some awesome stuff. I don't know what's going on with me today, but I guess I'm sick of listening to myself, and I'm really sick of listening to Bill. And I just wanted to hear you guys for some reason. I mean, if we could give each and every one of you 5 minutes to come share, that would probably feed my spirit more than anything else. And I don't know what that's about, but I'm enjoying that. So I want to thank the three of you for what you shared. It was real, real powerful for me. There's about 5 or 6 statements in this What is Acceptance article by Bill that I'd like to touch upon and maybe give about a minute of meditation for each one, if that's okay. And then I think Bill wants to take us through the evening review out of the 12 and 12, and that'll bring us to about quarter after the hour, and then we'll call it quits for the evening. So if we could just get quiet, assume the position, feet on the floor, hands on your lap, either folded or on your thighs, back straight, breathe, don't forget to breathe, usually helps. And try to conjure in your mind someone in your life that has maybe caused you some pain or heartache in the past or maybe present. And for the next minute or so, repeat this mantra and see what it brings to you. God, grant me the serenity to love their best and never fear their worst. God, grant me the serenity to love their best and never fear their worst. Meditate on this line for the next minute or so. Pain is the touchstone of progress. Pain is the touchstone of progress. fear no evil. Fear no evil. This too will pass. This experience can be turned to benefit. Take a deep breath. Exhale. And as if a bunch of different colored lights were radiating into your consciousness, let all those different lights be a full inventory of all your blessings and the many gifts that are yours, both temporal and spiritual. And just let all those gifts and all those benefits and all those blessings just radiate through your consciousness. And experience the gratitude associated with that.
Something that you might have noticed as that What is Acceptance by Bill Wilson article was being read is that throughout that article is about 3 or 4 exercises that can be used as a tool. Perhaps you could take advantage of those exercises in soon days. It's actually a really killer article. What I'd like to do now is do the evening review in the 12 and 12. We did this, the big book one yesterday. And what I'm going to do first is I'm going to read basically the whole evening review. It's only it's less than 2 pages. And then I'll pick out the inventory. Maybe we'll close our eyes again and then see how we did with the inventory using this tool. In the middle of page 93 in the 12 and 12, it says, "When evening comes, perhaps just before going to sleep, Many of us draw up a balance sheet for the day. This is a good place to remember that inventory taking is not always done in red ink. It's a poor day indeed when we haven't done something right. As a matter of fact, the waking hours are usually well filled with things that are constructive. Good intentions, good thoughts, good acts are there for us to see. Even when we have tried hard and failed, we may chalk that up as one of the greatest credits of all. Under these conditions, the pains of failure are converted into assets. Out of them, we receive the stimulation we need to go forward. Someone who knew what he was talking about once remarked that pain is the touchstone of all spiritual progress. How heartily we AAs can agree with him, for we know that the pains of drinking had to come before sobriety and emotional turmoil before serenity. As we glance down the debit side of the day's ledger, we should carefully examine our motives in each thought or act that appears to be wrong. Now notice as I go through this, these next few paragraphs just constantly keep mentioning our motives, our motives, our motives. You know, I saw one time where somebody said that it doesn't much matter, usually it doesn't much matter what we do. What matters more is why we do it. And don't get me wrong, you know, I'm sure the jails have people in there that did things, you know, with good motives. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about your average everyday as we go through life kind of a thing. But notice how often he says motives here. He already mentioned it once there. It says, in most cases, our motives won't be hard to see and understand. And notice this is activity as we're blocked off. It says, when prideful, angry, jealous, anxious, or fearful, we acted accordingly, and that was that. Here, we need only recognize that, one, we did act or think badly, two, try to visualize how we might have done better, and three, with God's help, resolve with God's help to carry these lessons over into tomorrow, making, of course, any amends still neglected. But in other cases, only the closest scrutiny will reveal what our true motives were. Again, motives. And again, here's some more spiritual malady or being spiritually blocked off. There are cases where our ancient enemy, rationalization, has stepped in and has justified conduct, which is really wrong. The temptation here is to imagine that we had good motives and reasons when we really didn't. Now, this whole next part is all spiritual malady stuff. It says, when constructively criticized, quote-unquote, someone who needed it, when our real motive was to win a useless argument. Or the person concerned not being present, we thought we were helping others to understand him when in actuality our true motive was to feel superior by pulling him down. We sometimes hurt those we love because they need to be taught a lesson, quote-unquote, when we really wanted to punish. So that last part is again a motive. We were depressed and complained we felt bad, when in fact we were mainly asking for sympathy and attention. This old trait of mind and emotion, this perverse wish to hide a bad motive underneath a good one, permeates human affairs from top to bottom. This subtle and elusive kind of self-righteousness can underlie the smallest act or thought. Learning daily to spot and admit. And notice the equation here. It says, learning daily to spot, admit, and correct these flaws is the essence of character building and good living. Two, an honest regret for harms done. Three, a genuine gratitude for blessings received. And four, a willingness to try for better things tomorrow will be the permanent assets we shall seek. And that's a promise. Having so considered our day, not admitting to take due note of things well done, and having searched our hearts with neither fear nor favor, we can truly thank God for the blessings we have received and sleep in good conscience. That's a little bit of a prayer as well as a promise at the end there. So that's the 12 and 12's evening review. And perhaps we can get still again. And I'll go over a couple of these sentences individually, and we'll give us some time to review our day. We could, let's get still and Just try to be in the moment. Yes, God, what to show us what he would have us see. As we glance down the debit side of the day's ledger, we should carefully examine our motives in each thought or act that appears to be wrong. In most cases, our motives won't be hard to see and understand. So what were our motives as we went through the day? With the many conversations that we had? Perhaps if we went into town interacting with shop owners. Maybe the workers in the house. And with each other. Talks about looking for times during today when perhaps we are prideful. Do we say any of that as we look through our day? It asks if there were moments in the day today where we were angry. Maybe jealous. Anxious or fearful. And it says to try to visualize how we might have done better if we did find any of these in our day. What perhaps is a better way? What should we have done instead? And then resolve with God's help to carry these lessons over into tomorrow, making, of course, any amends still neglected. Since we're still mostly with the people that we have been with all day, maybe that amends can occur tonight instead of waiting until tomorrow. Did we constructively criticize someone who needed it when our real motive was to win a useless argument? Was the person we were talking about not being present when we thought we were helping others to understand him when in actuality our true motive was to feel superior by pulling him down? Did we hurt someone around us because they needed to be taught a lesson when we really wanted to punish? Perhaps we were depressed and complained that we felt bad when in fact we were mainly asking for sympathy and attention. Did we exhibit the subtle and elusive kind of self-righteousness that can underlie the smallest act or thought as we look back over this day? Did we practice today as we went through the day the process of learning daily to spot, admit, and correct these type of flaws, which leads us to the essence of character building and good living? Experiencing an honest regret for harms done and a genuine gratitude for blessings received. Did we exhibit today a willingness to try for better things? And in closing, we can truly thank God for the blessings we have received. And perhaps, in a short time, sleep in good conscience.